first thing I thought of when I heard about it is, how does the press get this information that's classified? How do they do it? You know why? Because it's an illegal process, and the press should be ashamed of themselves. But more importantly, the people that gave out the information to the press should be ashamed of themselves. Really ashamed.
President Donald Trump speaking earlier this week about the stream of leaks coming out of his administration. Some of them have involved classified information, like the details of calls between Trump's ousted National Security Advisor, General Michael Flynn, and the U.S. Russian ambassador. The pace at which the leaks are coming has created some concerns that the U.S. is veering toward the creation of a deep state. These are powerful networks of people within government agencies who conspire to undermine how it functions. Joining us to talk about deep states is Amanda Taub. She writes the interpreter column for the New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, that sounds really ominous, a deep state. It suggests a shadowy conspiracy. What does it mean, actually?
So usually when people talk about a deep state, they are talking about countries like Turkey, Egypt, Pakistan, where there are groups of powerful people, often within the military and intelligence services, who have been known to conspire with each other to manipulate or obstruct or even overthrow the elected government. But I would say, you know, despite the worries that we could be headed in that direction in the United States, we're very, very far from that. So, you know, right. Ominous discussion aside, it's important to kind of start with some perspective on this.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning countries that don't have a long history of democracy and veer towards autocracy. And so what, though, are you talking about with all of these leaks and what fears do they raise?
So we've been some level of leaking is normal in every administration. It's something that is the feature of every presidency. But the level and frequency of leaks so far in the Trump administration is really unprecedented, particularly because this is only the first month. They haven't even had a chance to make very many policies yet, so it's not a situation where there's necessarily even deep policy disagreement yet. What we're seeing is a sign of major dysfunction within the executive branch, and the leaking is really a symptom of that. So the experts who I spoke to for this piece said that one way to think about a deep state is as an extreme version of political conflict between a nation's leader and the institutions that make it run. So institutions like the intelligence agencies, the military, their, you know, State Department, things like that. And so even though we're very far from any kind of conspiracy or shadowy network here in the United States, we are already seeing signs of conflict between the White House and executive agencies.
But some might say, well, that's a good thing because these executive agencies, the leakers, are letting truth out and that this would be a good thing for our democracy.
So I think what is happening here are a lot of decisions are being made that are completely, you know, perhaps justifiable for the most part on the individual level. And, you know, I'm a journalist. I understand absolutely the value of leaked information. It can be vital to democracy to have information that the public needs get out. But what I think we're seeing here is not just that. What we're seeing here is what happens when there's a breakdown in communication and trust between the White House and the executive agencies that are supposed to be making the country run. And so because people don't have confidence in the normal channels of government, in large part because President Trump has already violated so many of the norms and unwritten rules of the way presidents do things, we're in this situation of escalating distrust where, as you say, people think, oh, you know, these are extreme times. I need to do this to get the information out there. I have no other choice. The Trump administration takes that as an act of kind of political warfare, ratchets up its kind of rhetoric about how much it distrusts the agencies, trust breaks down further. And I think we could be headed towards a situation of real dysfunction and real governmental paralysis.
And are you speaking in particular about the intelligence agencies and about this call that Michael Flynn made to the Russian ambassador?
So I think that is the most recent and most prominent example of what I'm talking about here, which was that, you know, it's important to note that Mike Flynn was not somebody who I think was particularly popular to begin with the intelligence agencies. So it's worrying to think that that could have played into this. But they released information through leaks about this call between him and the Russian ambassador that was recorded without his knowledge. And it's really unprecedented to have that kind of information made public. You know, it's normally a pretty closely held secret for the government. And so I think that speaks to the level of distrust and the level of people feeling like this is an extreme situation, that the information had already been distributed internally. It had already been given to the White House. And so, you know, you could look at this as just panic within the intelligence agencies thinking, you know, we've done this the normal way. It hasn't worked. This is important. We need to make it public. But then the result of that is, you know, if it continues, the result of it will be the release of classified information.
Mm-hmm. Which, again, some might argue is necessary if you have an administration that is overly secretive. You know, you go back to Nixon and you think, well, had there not been leaks, then there would have been no Watergate scandal, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And I think that's absolutely the key thing to understand here is that this is not a one-sided situation of leaking. This is each side responding to the other with distrust. But even if these leaks are happening, because they are looking and saying, you know, this is unprecedented, this administration is too secretive, this administration is not doing the right thing, and people need to know, in the aggregate, that can lead to paralysis and breakdown in function. So even if individual leaks are absolutely justified, ideally, that's not the way our government runs.
Well, these are different times for sure. Amanda Taub writes the interpreter column for The New York Times, where you can read her piece on the deep state. Thank you very much, Amanda.
Thank you.
Well, President Trump is set to rally his supporters in Florida tomorrow. It's been a tough week for the president. There was the Michael Flynn kerfuffle. His pick for labor secretary was panned, and he had to withdraw. And then there was that combative press conference yesterday.
The press has become so dishonest that if we don't talk about it, we are doing a tremendous disservice to the American people. Tremendous disservice. We have to talk about it to find out what's going on, because the press honestly is out of control. The level of dishonesty is out of control.
So how did that play with his supporters, and how are they viewing his first month in office? Joining us now are two local Trump backers. Mary Allen is a life and business coach in Laguna Niguel. Welcome to you.
Hello, hello. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Wayne Smith is a real estate agent in Newport Beach. Welcome to you.
Great morning to you as well.
Mary, this combative tone with the media, is that what you want to hear?
I think, honestly, that for him to just go into a press conference and not ignore the fact that a good majority of the media out there is anti-Trump and is looking at everything to be so negative, I think it is important that we have the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And by anti-Trump, what do you mean?
By the media really choosing to focus on every little thing that is negative about Trump, as opposed to highlighting all the great decisions that he's been making so far, how quickly he is moving, how he's organizing his cabinet, and how at least a good, I don't know, 55% of the population is actually really excited about the choices that he's making, a lot of the choices he's making.
And before we get to your feelings about what he's done in a positive sense, I want to get to you, Wayne, and just ask the same question. What is your opinion when you see the president go after the media in the way that he did yesterday?
I don't think he necessarily directly went after the media. I think President Trump has incredibly great management skills. He's laying the foundation so we can move forward and start working on America's problems instead of working on all the fake news and all the BS that you hear from all of the news agencies.
What's the fake news?
The big thing that's taken up a lot of time is the Russians infiltrating the election, all the negative articles that are coming out. And that's probably the number one.
Well, just let me drill down on that a little bit in terms of the Russians infiltrating the election, as you put it. This was the assessment of the intelligence community, not the assessment of the media, which just reported that news. So how is that fake news?
I don't think the American people are hearing the correct news across the board from everyone. They're not receiving the news from both sides of the party that are completely accurate.
Mary, what do you like that the president has done so far in his, it's about a month he's been in office?
I love that he is working very quickly to secure our borders and put a halt on, you know, with his travel ban. I love his cabinet choices. I mean, he's moving forward on all fronts.
So the travel ban was put on hold by the courts. It's working its way through the court system, but it's dead for now, and it might be dead forever. What do you make of that?
I think this is a big mistake on the Ninth Circuit Court. I think that there's nothing at all wrong. We've done it many different times through the centuries where we have put a hold on immigration temporarily to allow for integration and assimilation within our own country. And in this case, where we have such a crisis with ISIS, you know, these seven countries that were identified with the Obama administration as having terrorists, and then the president of Syria himself even saying there are probably terrorists coming through as refugees. I mean, the president of Syria making that comment, I mean, that's pretty concerning, and yet we want to just flood the gates in with more and more people, which I think it was smart to do the travel ban the way he did.
So let me ask you this. Where do both of you get your news?
Mostly through Fox, but I also switch over to CNN and MSNBC every so often, and then Facebook is a great source because you get people that are clearly posting things that they feel are super passionate about, so that ends up being a good source for me as well.
Mm-hmm. And Wayne?
Both Fox, CNN, and I listen to talk radio during the day.
Okay. And so out of all of that, do you trust your news sources?
One media is very liberal, one media is very conservative, and between both of them, somewhere in the middle lies the truth. Mm. I don't believe it's 100% either way.
So according to a Pew Research poll, President Trump has 84% of Republicans or people who lean Republican approve of his job performance so far as of February, as opposed to just 8% of Democrats. And that's really a low point in terms of the division. How do you think, Mary, the two sides of this country can be brought together?
I think a big part is for us to all come back and remember that we're all American and we all want a lot of the same things. We want a safe country, an economy that's thriving, where people are working and we're minimizing welfare. We want to be happy. We want to have the freedom to make choices for ourselves and not have things dictated by the government about the choices that are going to make us happy. I think right now we need to be balancing out the extreme that Democrat Party has implemented in the U.S. And let's allow ourselves to go back to a little bit of balance and stay focused on what's important.
And so, Wayne, what do you think when you see this great disparity with 84% of Republicans supporting the president and only 8% of Democrats supporting him? What do you make of that?
We have to stop pointing the finger at each other, and both sides of the aisle have to stop calling each other's names and stop criticizing each other. The reason we have two ears and one mouth is we should listen to each other's point of views and try to reason and try to come to an understanding working together and working these problems out.
Well, when you see the president, let me ask you this. When you see the president calling people names, calling the Democratic minority leader weak, mocking him, mocking the media, does that at all play into this division?
I don't necessarily agree with him calling anyone names. You don't satisfy and you don't solve any problems doing it this way. If we were able to sit down and negotiate and talk about the problems that we really have and what we really need to do, would be the best way of solving these problems.
What do you think, Mary? Do you think that the president could perhaps moderate his tone a bit?
I think he could. And I also think that the media can be instrumental in bringing our country together. Trump made a beautiful point, actually, at the press conference about how angry the liberal media really is. And it's the media that continues to feed the beliefs of those people that weren't in support of Trump, where the media can look and find, you know, what is he doing great for our country? And how might these steps work? And even Obama himself said, you know, if you can come up with a health care plan that's better than mine, he's like, I would even get behind you and support you on that. There's no sense of optimism at all from the liberal media. And this is where you have the power to bring us together or to continue to deepen the divide. And I just really hope that those that have that influence in the media really is our fourth branch of government. You know, we need that balance for the good of the country.
Well, hopefully this conversation will go a little ways toward doing that. Mary Allen is a life and business coach in Laguna Niguel, Wayne Smith, real estate agent in Newport Beach. Thank you both so much for coming on today.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for having
us.
And if you're a Trump supporter in Southern California, we want to hear from you. What do you make of the first month of his presidency? You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, confusion over the United States position on Israel and the Palestinians. Is it one state? Is it two states? We'll speak with a Middle East expert on Donald Trump's policies and how they're playing in the region next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump's choice for ambassador to Israel faced a tough grilling by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. Senators weren't the only ones going after David Friedman.
My grandfather was exiled, was kicked out by the state of Israel, Mr. Friedman, and I'm right here, Mr. Friedman, holding up the Palestinian flag right behind you.
Several protesters interrupted the hearing. Not too surprising, given Friedman's far-right stance on Israel. But he insisted that a two-state solution would be a, quote, tremendous benefit to both Israelis and Palestinians. Friedman's comments come on the heels of a press conference in which President Trump seemed to waffle on this pillar of Middle East policy. Well, it's been a big week for American-Israeli relations, and so we called up Aaron David Miller to help us sort it out. He's vice president at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and former Middle East negotiator under Republican and Democratic administrations. I began by asking him about that press conference earlier this week.
Well, the way Mr. Trump reacts to this issue and many others, both as a president-elect and as a president, I think responds to an interplay between three basic issues. Number one is his persona and his tendency to put himself in the middle of the conversation as a breaker of icons and a kind of disruptor in chief. Second is his tendency to want to fulfill campaign commitments and to distance himself at all costs and at any price from his predecessor, Barack Obama. Those two factors, however, interact with a third, which is the reality is he cannot suspend the laws of gravity that govern the transition from campaigning to governing. And what's happened, whether it's one China or NATO, or now on this issue of the two-state solution, is he disrupts without thinking clearly about the consequences and implications, but leaves himself room to maneuver back toward the center, which I think is what he's done in this particular case. But I suspect sooner rather than later, reaching out to the Arabs or not, they're going to face the reality that an Israeli-Palestinian deal confronting the same issues that his predecessors have confronted is going to end up being the focal point of their policy.
He does, by all accounts, have a much warmer relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu than President Obama had. Could that work in terms of moving this process forward?
You know, personality is critically important. In large part, this will be driven by substance and by policy issues. At the beginning, there's no question. This meeting, first and foremost, was an effort to basically make it unmistakably clear to anybody who was listening or watching that the U.S.-Israeli relationship was going to be different. It has nowhere to go but up. It is not going to have the acrimony that characterized the relationship between Obama and Netanyahu. Right now, frankly, there's nothing to fight about. And yeah, I think both of these guys went to great lengths to give one another enormous kudos and a lot of space. But that is going to come under strain because in the end, just as its tensions have been produced among their predecessors, where you stand has a lot to do with where you sit. And Israel and the U.S. are sitting in very different places.
Well, let's talk about what Benjamin Netanyahu talked about or indicated, that he would be any peace deal would have to include tie-ins with neighboring Arab countries. You know, as we said, this has been a stalemate for a long time. Has anything shifted for him to make this rather optimistic statement that he could perhaps work with neighboring Arab countries?
I think there is one thing that is different. There's no question. It's undeniable that a community coincidence of interest has emerged between Israel and several key Sunni Arab states, the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Egyptians, and the Jordanians. On one hand, you have a rising Iran. And on the other hand, there's the threat from the Sunni jihadis, ISIS, and all the al-Qaeda derivatives. The question is whether or not this coincidence of interest will translate into actual breakthroughs with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That is a proposition yet to be tested. And I suspect that what Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Trump will find is that, sure, the Arabs will be willing to reach out to the Israelis. Look at the 2002 Arab Peace Initiative. But there will be a price, and the price will not be cheap.
Now, any significant deal cannot be made without the United States participating. But I'm wondering what the credibility is now with keeping in mind Donald Trump's attempt at a travel ban from seven majority Muslim nations and his vow to go after ISIS. What is his credibility now in the larger Middle East in terms of being able to come in and work with the Arab states, Israel, and the Palestinians for a peace deal?
I mean, I think it depends which Arab state and on which issue. He has done two things, I think, that are very welcome to both the Saudis and the Egyptians. Number one, he has toughened up his policy with respect to Iran, and it's clear that whatever improvement there may or may not have been during the Obama administration in the U.S.-Iranian bilateral relationship, that relationship is essentially frozen, or more likely, frankly, it's going to deteriorate. That makes the Saudis and also the Israelis very happy. Second, clearly, he has put forth a view of the world which is very risk-averse when it comes to the United States interceding, meddling, let alone nation-building in this region or in any other. And what that means to someone like Abdel Fattah Sisi in Egypt is that he is persuaded, and I think I am too, that the Trump administration is going to give any kind of human rights issue a pass. Sisi basically is cracking down in a way that was worse than Mubarak. There are probably more people in jail. And I think, by and large, the president, that is to say Mr. Trump, really isn't interested in interceding or moralizing or telling these strong men how to behave. You may also see a greater willingness to acquiesce in Bashar Assad's efforts to consolidate his own control and power, because Mr. Trump is interested in cutting some sort of deal, he alleges, or opines, with Mr. Putin. So I think in that sense, there is credibility. Whether or not Donald Trump is trusted by these Arab leaders, I think we're a long way away from the Arabs basically reaching any bottom line judgment on that.
Okay, and finally, let's talk about Iran. And it seems like the Iranians are complying with the nuclear deal. The United States or the White House has indicated that this deal is a terrible deal and it wants to pull out, but it hasn't. What would happen if the United States pulled out? And do you think it will?
I mean, I don't think abrogation of the accord is an option, despite what Mr. Trump said in the campaign, despite the fact that during his meeting with Mr. Netanyahu during the presser, I think he referred to it as the worst agreement ever negotiated. I think renegotiation is simply impossible. I think you're going to end up with an effort on the part of this administration for now to maintain what I think is going to be two parallel non-intersecting tracks. Number one is observance of the agreement, assuming the Iranians comply. The second is toughening up our response to Iranian behavior. Now, what that means, it's the now resigned or fired Mike Flynn's notion of putting Iran on notice. What that means exactly is unclear. Interdicting weapon shipments from Iran to the Houthis, not allowing Iranian Revolutionary Guard fast boats to challenge American naval vessels without a price, which would presumably mean if they come close, rather than fire warning shots, destroying them. So I think that's the second track. The question is, can you keep these two tracks separate? Can you continue to adhere to the agreement and yet confront Iranian behavior in the region, particularly given the fact that Congress is going to want to impose new sanctions? And in the run-up to Iranian elections, I think in May of this year, you're going to get a hardening, I suspect, of conservative opinion in Iran and an effort to use the United States as the boogeyman. So you could end up, at the end of the day, while not abrogating the accord unilaterally, not renegotiating it, it could simply begin to be put in jeopardy by death through a thousand cuts, if you will.
Well, given the rhetoric that we've heard coming out of the White House regarding Muslims, or at least what they call radical Islam, and anti-Iran statements, are you worried that they are amping up the threat of military action against Iran?
I mean, it's odd because you have in Pyongyang a situation far worse than you do in Iran. You have in North Korea a guy who already has developed anywhere from 10 to 15 nuclear weapons and is now working on a delivery system. And yet you see restraint on the part of the administration. You don't see the National Security Advisor, the president, putting Kim Jong-un on notice. My point is that I think you're right, Madeline, is that I think the tendency to react tougher, in a tougher way to the Iranians because they're weaker and they're more vulnerable than North Korea, may be greater. So yeah, I'm worried. I think it's only a matter of time before you begin to have an escalatory cycle. The question is, when it happens, can it be controlled? Or will it continue to escalate? But I think the chances of a U.S.-Iranian military confrontation somewhere have gone up substantially.
Aaron David Miller, Vice President at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you for joining us.
Madeline, thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a break from the news and talk about movies coming out this week, including the documentary Kedi about kitties in Istanbul.
We had harnesses that we had sewn with like tiny little cameras that we thought they would wear, which of course they didn't.
A feel-good, yes, pun intended, movie about cats next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The main characters of the new documentary, Kedi, have a lot to say. Kedi means cat in Turkish. And in Istanbul, stray kedis have freely roamed the city for thousands of years. The film, Kedi, follows some of these cats through the streets, along the harbors, and into the nooks and crannies of the city, and offers a meditation on what it means to live, love, and die in close quarters with these mysterious animals. Jada Torin directed the film, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. You live here, right? But you were born in Istanbul?
I was born in Istanbul, and we lived there till I was about 11.
And there are cats everywhere?
There are cats everywhere.
But it goes more beyond that because, you know, people are everywhere, so you'd think cats would be everywhere. But there's the rare city where cats are allowed to roam so freely and seem to be loved so much by the people, the inhabitants. So what is it about that bond between the Turks or the people who live in Istanbul and the cats?
Well, it seems to be multifaceted. There's this one element that in Islam, the cat is considered the closest to being holy, although it's not technically a holy animal, but because there are a lot of references to stories where the Prophet Muhammad, let's say when a cat falls asleep on the skirts of his robe, and when he's ready to get up and go for a prayer, he doesn't want to wake up the cat, so he cuts his robe around the cat so he can leave without waking him up. And there's many other references like this. So I think there's a acceptance of people's affection and display of affection for cats. But I think there's also a cultural affinity for cats because they're, you know, they're a wonderful way to express our affections in otherwise perhaps stunted sort of displays of affection.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, there's one character in your movie, a woman, who says cats are able to express being a woman the way, in ways that women in Turkey aren't allowed to.
Well, I think it's, if you express your femininity too openly and too freely, it can be misinterpreted as being loose in some cultures or brazen or sassy. And if you don't express your femininity, then you're considered either cold, distant, frigid, or unfeminine, just not a woman. So it's a very delicate balance, and it's somehow put upon us to have to deal with. And this one artist who was talking about the femininity of the cats was bringing it up because it seems like cats don't really care what people think of them. And as a result, it seems like nobody judges them. So yeah. It's quite beautiful.
But same thing with dogs, though, right?
Not quite. Dogs seem to be, and I love dogs, I love all animals, but dogs seem to have a different kind of need from us. And they're frequently checking in with us to see if what they're doing is okay. Whereas cats, anyone who has cats or deals with cats knows that they expect to be accepted as they are.
So in your movie, you follow several cats. They become the characters, and you really get to know them. They have distinct personalities. How did you choose the cats? Out of all the cats in Istanbul, why those several cats?
We did research the previous year to see how we could even formulate this film. Because we obviously wanted it to be visual and interesting. But in the end, we had leads to 35 cat stories, out of which we were only able to film 19 for logistic reasons or for the sake that the cat just didn't show up.
Because it's a cat.
It's a cat. And in the edit, it came down to 7 that actually made sense and when strung together created this sort of more emotional journey.
So you do explore the relationship between cats and humans, and cats are famously mysterious animals and famously mercurial. What did you discover about this relationship, and what did you learn about the cats that you didn't know before?
The greatest thing they do, for me at least, is that they force me to be present. There's something about cats that take me to think more about the philosophical, more existential, more questioning of my place in the world. And so the more we talk to, and when we talk to people on the streets about this, and they brought it up on their own, these sort of existential comments that they had or insights that they had, then I thought, well, maybe this wasn't so particular to me. This is not an experience that is unique to me. It seems like people all have this kind of feeling, feelings that are evoked by cats. But in terms of scientific things that I found out, I got to see a fossilized skeleton of a cat that was 3,500 years old from the shores of the Bosphorus.
Wow.
That apparently had a break in his leg that was healed by a human, or could have only been healed by a human. So it just makes you think, you know, this relationship predates any other existence that we've known in Istanbul or what we know now, which it makes it even more magical and mystical. And thinking if they have 9 lives, those 9 lives are happening over, you know, thousands of years is pretty impressive.
Wow. Yeah. But you do talk about the present in terms of modernity crowding in on the cat's freedom, the fact that there's all this building happening and that their habitats are getting, you know, sort of squeezed a little bit. And talk about that sort of conflict between the cats being able to roam freely and developers wanting to build and make a more human landscape.
I think there's a direct parallel also between how we exist as human beings and how cats exist in cities. And for example, I was able to play ball on the streets with my friends as a kid. Now, no one's kid really gets a chance to do that because there are too many buildings and there's not enough streets and too many cars parking on streets. So the commentary about in the film about their environment changing was also motivated by a desire to highlight that the impact of that on our lives and on the lives of our children.
You filmed it. You had this sort of, can I say, cat's eye view
yes.
of filming? I know it's a little bit tortured. But anyway, so you filmed it from their point of view for many of the scenes. How are you able to do that without scaring them off?
They are used to people. They're really used to people
right.
being around them and walking alongside them. So they didn't mind us with a camera. They minded we had modified remote control trucks that we fitted with cameras, which they didn't really love too much. We had harnesses that we had sewn to with like tiny little cameras that we thought they would wear, which of course they didn't. Or if they did, they just sat. But so in the end, we had two Canon 5Ds that we basically created these two rigs for that allowed us to bring them as low to the ground as possible without having to hunch over for focus and adjustments. And, you know, our biggest fear was that how are we going to manipulate these guys? And we didn't want to manipulate any of their action. And in the end, we didn't really have to. They just allowed us to follow them. Or if we beckoned them with the traditional Turkish pss, pss, which is how you call any cat to do anything in Turkey.
How do you do it?
Pss, 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 pss. There you go. Now you know when you go to Istanbul.
I wonder if it works with American cats.
I've tried. It doesn't work.
Really?
It must be a language thing, yeah.
So this is a film that I found really a nice antidote to all the news and all the stress that we're getting now through our media. You know, it's set in Turkey, and there's been a lot of political upheaval in Turkey, political protests against Erdogan, etc. But that's not in your movie at all. And did you consciously not want to include that?
Absolutely. It wasn't. It was something that I struggled with personally because I am from Istanbul, but that Charlie and I, who produced this film with me, constantly discussed over and over because we didn't want to blatantly ignore it or create this ideal scenario of Turkey. But at the same time, it was almost an act of defiance to say we will not acknowledge the whimsical political decisions of various individuals and rather focus on this timeless relationship that I hope, that we hope, will persevere and still be there 2,000 years from now.
Well, Jada Torin, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Jada Torin's new film is called Kedi, Turkish for cat. Kitty. Kitty, really.
Kitty.
Kitty, kitty. It opens tonight in theaters across Los Angeles. Coming up, more movies. What else you can see this weekend in Los Angeles? Our weekly film reviews are next. On Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We cannot end the week without doing some film reviews. And here to tell us more about the movies coming out this week, Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the new movie podcast called Skill Set. Hi.
Hello.
And April Wolf is joining us, lead film critic for LA Weekly. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Let's begin with The Great Wall. This is the blockbuster action release for the week starring Matt Damon. Here's a bite from the trailer.
The Great Wall is the only barrier keeping the world safe. Mother of God. What is it they want?
That is a good question. What is it that we want from this movie, Amy?
Well, I think what we really want is to laugh at the idea of a great wall helping us in any sort of way possible. I mean, for people who know their Chinese history, the Great Wall took a million lives to build and got breached constantly. Uh-huh. Here, at least, they're fighting a legendary villain. They're not fighting the Mongols or the Tatars. They're fighting aliens, literal aliens, who have landed on China from a meteor. And they look like your generic CG bad guy villains. They're lizards and green and covered in fangs and they drool all the time.
Is that supposed to be a metaphor for immigrants or?
You know, maybe? Probably not. Probably not. It's probably just supposed to be their version of a gigantic epic starring Matt Damon, who they have bought and purchased to come over there and star in this movie, but directed by Yimou Zhang, who did Hero and House of Flying Daggers and Raise the Red Lantern. And he takes this movie very seriously, probably more seriously than you should, given that this is a movie where the Great Wall is revealed to have giant scissors on the inside that are designed to cut lizards in half when they climb up to eat all of our good heroes.
It sounds humorous.
I wish it was. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of Gods of Egypt, the film that came out at this time last year, which also I thought was goofy and had the same problem as this one does in that it stars a white guy. But I feel like the hero of this movie actually doesn't turn out to be Matt Damon. You're expecting him to come in and save the day. Instead, this movie is really this ode to a Chinese actress named Tian Jing, who plays this hero, Commander Yin, and she is fantastic. She's this tiny little thing with a high ponytail. She's part of the Crane Corps, who are bungee jumpers with javelins. You have to see that. But she's amazing, and she owns the movie. Like, this is really a tribute to her.
Huh. And then Matt Damon has an Irish accent.
I don't know if it's Irish or just, like, Scottish with Tarzan, like this. Because there's some kind of, like, yes, I would like to do that. Like croc or something, you know? So sometimes it switches into, like, maybe he thought he got cast in Tarzan and just kind of, like, prepared for
but,
the role.
But, it doesn't seem like he's that into it.
And no, and honestly, I would love to see the cut of it that they screen in Chinese theaters.
Yeah.
That's what I would love to see. Because,
is it
you
a
know,
totally different movie?
It may be a totally different movie because the standard practice is, you know, they have these white American actors come over and kind of build up the star power of their own actor starring alongside them. But then they kind of cut their part down. And so the Chinese actors end up taking, you know, the stage. And of course, that actress, she's awesome. And, you know, the stunts, you know, the cinematography, everything is there. That director, I mean, you know, when you say that he did Hero, it's just like, yeah, Hero. I mean, Hero is like the movie that inspired all the guys who made John Wick and John Wick 2. Like, it's a great film. This is a great director. And it really makes me wonder what China is seeing and what we're not, you know, because we're given some kind of like quippy back and forth with Matt Damon. And it's just it's not working.
All right. Let's move on to XX. This is a horror anthology of stories directed by women. And here's a bit of the trailer.
What's in the box?
Present.
Can I see?
Danny,
stop being so nosy.
It's OK.
Okay, so women directing horror movies, there are four of them, right?
Four women, yes.
Four short films in this big film.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, horror anthologies are pretty big these past few years, but only, I think, 6 out of 96 directors of, like, the top 5 grossing anthologies are women. So this is kind of like this push to try to get more women into it. I actually enjoyed, you know, I would say about 2.5 out of 4 of these shorts. And to me, that's still a win because anthologies, you know, are kind of hit and miss. But what happens in this movie is you have these four directors who maybe shouldn't be paired up together because they only have in common that they are women. Mm-hmm. And I think a great anthology is kind of like building a great album where, you know, it kind of goes on a narrative arc throughout the album, you know, where each short is placed next to one that kind of builds on the theme before and takes it in a different place. And they didn't really have the luxury of doing that. I think that they had just given these women kind of free rein and were just like, do whatever you want. But, you know, a great anthology would be you take these women, you're like, oh, okay, I see what you've done before. Karen Kusama,
who's great.
Did,
yeah.
Oh, The Invitation. She did a short called Her Only Living Son for this. And it was a riff on Rosemary's Baby and The Omen. And great directorial shots, you know, a lot of camera movement, a lot of slow panning and kind of mood building. And there's also some really beautiful wry humor that kind of reminds me of those old kind of Tales from the Crypt, Creepshow, irony, twists. And I think it would have been a service to Karen if her short had been placed next to one, for instance, that had a slightly more looped in theme.
Okay, so that's XX. And let's move on to another horror movie. This one's called A Cure for Wellness.
There is a sickness inside us, rising like the bile that leaves that bitter taste at the back of our throats. It's there in every one of you seated around the table. Only when we know what ails us can we hope to find the cure.
Okay, Amy, is it good? Do we want to know what the cure is?
The cure is eels. I don't think that's okay. Too much of a spoiler. that's telegraphed very, very early on. But what's happening here in A Cure for Wellness is it starts off at this rich global conglomerate corporate office where the head of the company has taken off to this facility in Switzerland that's supposed to heal you. And he's sent behind this like Jerry Maguire-ish opus about how we're all living life wrong. A young employee, Dane DeHaan, is sent after him to go bring him back. He thinks he's going to be there for hours. He's there, et cetera, dot, 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 until eels attack him in many different permutations. Dane DeHaan is a young actor who I root for off and on. I really like him. He was the star of the movie Chronicle. He was in the Metallica movie, Some Kind of Monster. Uh-huh. He looks like a young Leonardo DiCaprio. And in Cure for Wellness, I think they do a really good job of making him look like a young guy who could also potentially be sick. You know, he's got these sunken in eyes and skinny legs and a soft belly. And you watch him pat around these medical halls trying to get to the secret society of what is happening here in this facility. And you're rooting for him as much as he might be one of the biggest jerks I've seen on film all year. I mean, he really is just like this hot-headed alpha male guy who thinks he can control the universe and winds up just subject to the evil machinations of this doctor played by Jason Isaacs.
So are you glad that he's the subject of these evil machinations because he's a jerk?
I mean, it kind of deserves it.
Yeah. April, what did you think?
I mean, the first part of the film, I feel like he was kind of working almost in like a 70s kind of psychological horror. You have these like a deer that appears in a steam room, and the steam room has disappearing doorways and entryways. And so you're not quite sure if anything is happening is real or not. So it's more supernatural. But then halfway through the film, they introduce this young woman, and it turns more into gothic horror. And I would say probably even like 1930s gothic horror. We're going back to like Bela Lugosi kind of cheese gothic horror. So there's something that's almost enjoyable about that. But
yeah, you can tell that the director Gore Verbinski is having a ton of fun. But whether he's having 2.5 hours worth of fun for us is the harder question. But there are some scenes in here I love, like when Dane DeHaan and the girl who's played by Mia Goth, who's maybe best known for being Shia LaBeouf's like fiance, off again, on again fiance, who starred with him in Nymphomaniac. She has this way of looking 13 and 40 at the same time. And here there's a scene where they like escape and run down the hill for a little bit and go into a bar with all the locals. And it is so tense and high energy and kind of that ghetto European dark mystery where you don't know what is going to happen. That scene really sold me on the movie I wanted this to be.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. Yet another horror film. This seems like the week for horror. American Fable.
Where did he come from?
He is not one of us.
I can give you anything you want. I can do that. Anything you want in the whole world.
If someone wants you to keep a secret, should you keep it?
All right, April, you saw this one. Worth seeing? What's it about?
Yeah, visually, I think this film is pretty stunning. It's about a little girl, about 11 years old, and she lives in Iowa. It's the 1980s, and farms are failing all over the place. And her family is having arguments. They own a farm, and they're not quite sure what's going to happen. And then she one day stumbles upon this man, kind of like a well-dressed man, who's just in their family silo on the edge of the property. I'm not going to give too much away, but you get to see the story through her as she's kind of putting it together. The director, Anne Hamilton, she doesn't give much away. It is a quite slow story, more impressionistic, I would say. Hamilton actually worked with Terrence Malick.
Is it shot in the magic hour all that?
It's all golden magic hour. Uh-huh. Yeah, and the cornfields are just endless. And I think she was pretty inspired by Edward Hopper. And
so underneath all that, golden waves of amber is rot.
The thing is, I think that I was so captured by the nostalgia, being a Midwesterner myself and, you know, working class. And I think that I hung in there through some of the slower parts in the middle. But I think that I was so attached to the conversations that are quite small that she was having with her father, where she's asking, you know, these questions, why don't we ever leave? And it's the same kind of thing that I remember asking, you know, my family, why don't we ever leave? And their answer is like, this is the greatest place on earth.
So worth seeing of all the horror films this week?
I think it's
worth
seeing.
You like this one the best?
I think it marks a good directorial debut from someone to watch.
Okay. Well, that's a good note to end on. Yeah. April Wolf, lead film critic for the LA Weekly, and Amy Nicholson, chief film critic for MTV News and host of the movie podcast Skill Set. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Julie Myers is here to round out the week. Hello.
That's right. And guess what our listeners wanted to talk about today?
Keddie,
yes. Actually, we did have a couple people weigh in on that, but the preponderance of feedback today was about our two Trump supporters we had on earlier in the show talking about what they thought about Trump's policies so far. Andrew Spivak is a local Trump supporter. He says, "I love Trump. He actually puts America first for a change. Trump will hopefully permanently destroy the mainstream media, and for that, we should be eternally grateful." But Megan Kerr tweets, "I'm pretty sure that Trump is the one that's antagonizing the media, constantly calling them biased liars and discrediting their profession. So what's with that?" And Triceratops was concerned that it was not safe for him to be driving while the Trump supporters were on our radio, while the rain was pounding down on his car. So make of that what you will.
Okay, thank you very much. Hey, have a great weekend. Have a safe weekend out there. Try to stay dry. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Tuesday.